Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. A man who has been doing an outsized job over a very long time, protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, I'm happy to say, and always to the glory of God and his kingdom, is our friend Wayne Allen Root. He's well known to the Real America's Voice audience, of course, for his own program on this network, America's Top 10 Countdown. He is also the author of numerous best-selling books, including one we're going to talk a little bit about today, because there's some breaking news, I guess one might say, about the Great Patriot Boycott book. That is the follow-on to his wildly successful Great Patriot Protest and Boycott book. And he has managed in a way to make out of the second edition of the new book, the Boycott book, kind of a boycott and boycott synergy. It's great to have you with us, Wayne. Thank you for joining us once again. I know it's very, very hard to fit this in with everybody else that you're talking to, but we're very appreciative you've taken the time to do so.
And it's early in Las Vegas, only for you when I get up this early, Frank.
At this moment as we're taping, it is early in Las Vegas, and thank you for that especially.
And I'm very impressed that you can pronounce all the names of my two books. It's not easy. Try saying it five times fast.
I have tried saying it five times fast.
Protest and Boycott book and Great Patriot Boycott book. Not easy to say those fast, but you got them right. A lot of hosts don't.
I'm in training.
Impressed. And the newest one is, in fact, even though it's only been out 8 weeks, it's now in its second edition. We made some changes, and I guess that's what we should start with.
Tell us about that. It's very, very important work at hand, indeed.
What I call teachable moment. You'll see, first of all, you'll see on the cover, one change I wanted to make right away was my book was endorsed by President Donald J. Trump. So we put on the cover, endorsed by Trump, and then on the back, we put the actual quote, which I want to read you real quick. It's time to beat the radical left at their own game. Money does talk. Anheuser-Busch now understands that. Great new book by Wayne Allen Root. Buy your copy today, Donald J. Trump, 45th President of the United States. And he was talking about the Great Patriot Boycott book. So this is kind of
that would be worth a second edition all by itself, I think.
All by itself, but that wasn't the main reason we did it. First of all, we found seven new companies in the 8 weeks since it came out. We were told by all these different people, Wayne, you missed this company, you missed that company. You got to add these companies. They're so great. So we put out a second edition and we added seven new companies. Now there's 128 great companies that patriots and conservatives and people of faith, Christians, as an example, who go to church on Sunday morning, can spend their money with and feel like, I'm not giving it to the enemy. I'm not giving it to evil people. I'm not giving it to someone who's going to turn around and use my money to destroy everything I believe in, including America and Judeo-Christian values.
Or
so
you personally,
these are 128
perhaps.
Great companies. Yeah. And then I eliminated two companies that were in the original edition out only 8 weeks ago. Two of them that were previously really good. After a year of research, we believed they were good enough to make the cut. You should support them and buy for them and watch them. And then all of a sudden, they made terrible decisions. And it's a teachable moment because we punish them. That's my whole theory. When a company goes bad, even if it's only short term, you got to punish them. So we eliminated them, deleted them from the book. And that was Fox News and Anheuser-Busch. They made the original cut of the book because Anheuser-Busch, which is the parent of Bud Light, has always given to mostly conservative and Republican causes. But all of a sudden, they made a sharp left-hand turn and they bought into the transgender bull spit. And we said, got to get rid of them. They're horrible. Got to punish them, bring them to their knees, bankrupt them. And Fox News has gone to the left, in my opinion, by getting rid of both Dan Bongino and Tucker Carlson and settling with Dominion and basically leaving in place a policy that we hate Trump and don't let anybody who likes Trump on the show. I can't get on Fox News anymore, which I find, I'm one of the leaders of the conservative movement in America, but I'm not allowed on a conservative network. That's because they're not very conservative anymore. So
that's
we threw them out.
The code.
Fox News gone and Anheuser-Busch gone. Brand new edition, seven new great companies, two that went bad are now gone. The Great Patriot Boycott book endorsed by President Donald J. Trump.
Let's just take another minute to drill down on these two examples, because it's so relevant to the fight we're in. And as you say, you know, the kind of censorship that we're seeing out of Fox News, witness your non-appearances there, but more to the point, the non-appearance any longer of two, you know, very prominent figures in American conservatism. Do you have a read on what the driving force is at work here in Fox News? We'll come to Anheuser-Busch, but, you know, I'm of the view that it has something to do with Paul Ryan being on the board of directors, but what are your thoughts?
Well, certainly you hit the nail on the head with that. Paul Ryan, Murdoch's sons, you know, Murdoch was always a big Republican conservative. Everything changed, Frank, in the last few years. When I was a kid growing up, my father said, you know, we're on the side of business. My father was a butcher, and I'm an SOB, a son of a butcher. But my dad understood capitalism and the importance of capitalism, because I always say to people, America's attached to Canada. America's attached to Mexico. Same dirt, but there's a line in the dirt, and the same air we breathe and the same ocean, you know, on both the North and the South. And yet we're so different. All the great things in history came from America, not from Canada, and certainly not from Mexico. Why is America so different? I think it's because we have free, unfettered capitalism and free speech. That's what made America different. Otherwise, we're just like every other country in the world. We are the king of capitalism. And yet there are people out there, forces that want to kill capitalism. So my dad always said, we're on the side of business, not just small business like my dad's butcher shop, but the average restaurant and the average restaurant chain with 300 restaurants and Walmart and all these big companies like Anheuser-Busch. Well, somewhere along the line, about 10 years ago, it all shifted. And I noticed Walmart suddenly went from super conservative to endorsing Obamacare. And I noticed Walmart was fighting the government when Republicans wanted to cut welfare and food stamps. Walmart said, no, our customers buy our stuff with welfare and food stamps. We want more welfare and food stamps. All of a sudden, all the big companies turned rancid and they all went left and they all went politically correct and they all went woke. And it's gotten only far worse in the last 5 years and the last 1 year. So I
especially with the advent of this so-called ESG movement,
yes, ESG,
which some
horrible.
Of the biggest of them, like
and of course
BlackRock,
also equity and
inclusion,
diversity,
it was
also horrible. And there's this demarcation line, small business. Frank, I'm a small business guy, and I have all my friends own one restaurant, one dry cleaner, three gas stations. They're all Republicans. I've never met a small business owner outside of maybe a gay nightclub that's a liberal. Everyone who owns a business is a Republican, but all the big businessmen are all liberals. Everyone I know who drives a Mercedes, most of them are Republicans, but everyone who drives a Rolls Royce is a liberal. It's become this demarcation line. If you're super rich, you have a private jet and a Rolls Royce, you suddenly don't like the people and you believe in Big Brother, and you're tied to government because probably you have government contracts. That's
this-
the reason.
This speaks to your whole theory of the case, doesn't it? That those people are now being rewarded for being woke.
Right.
Because just as President Trump says on your book, this is the left's game. They are punishing people who don't play with them. They are rewarding people who get the good ESG scores. And the truth of the matter is that those companies, those big businesses particularly, are less and less practicing capitalism and more, it seems to me, sort of indulging in a kind of fascism, a private-public partnership that is very problematic for our republic and certainly for the kind of innovations that you spoke of so highly that were, in fact, the wellspring of our capitalist system. Wayne, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk with you a little bit more about a couple of other examples of what's happening to our republic at the hands of, you know, that hard left effort, the Marxists, if you will. And we'll talk with that and more about the great patriot boycott right after this. this is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. There would never be a good time to say farewell to a magnificent patriot and courageous editorialist, essayist, and investigative reporter like my friend Claudia Rosette. But her loss at this particular moment in the arc of her profession is nothing short of devastating. For decades, Claudia epitomized the working journalist who served as our founders intended, namely as an independent, honest check on the three branches of government, fearlessly speaking truth to power. She did the same with tyrants abroad. Claudia Rosette was an exemplar of authentic reporting. More to the point, she practiced it the way we desperately require at present. Those who believe that it amounts to nothing more than reprinting official press releases and collaborating in the suppression of dissenting views will have a special place in hell, as Claudia surely has one in heaven. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back, and a very special welcome once again to Wayne Allen Root, a colleague here at Real America's Voice, and one of the leaders of our conservative movement, a thought leader, a force multiplier, if you will, with his very profound reach through various media platforms, including his podcasts and books, the most recent one of which is The Great Patriot Boycott, now in its second edition, with a very powerful endorsement from President Donald Trump. Why, he happens to have it right at hand. There he is.
I always have showman. It handy. Isn't that funny?
I know. Never leave home without it, as they say. So, Wayne, let me ask you, beyond the boycott, beyond what we're now responding to in terms of really challenges to our country in the business capitalism sense and arena, there are some public policy issues that I also wanted to visit with you about quickly. We don't have a lot of time to do justice to either of them, but I know you're a thoughtful guy and you've been talking about both of them. John Durham recently turned in his final report as special prosecutor, if I can use that term, the guy investigating what was done to Donald Trump, notably by the FBI, but also by, well, it turns out, President Obama, Vice President Biden back in 2017, and others, obviously Hillary Clinton as well. What did you make of this report, and where does it leave us at the moment?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, I make of it that it proves the weaponization of the federal government by Democrats, and Democrats really are masquerading as Democrats because at this point they're openly socialist Marxists and communists. And by the way, socialism, for those who don't understand the difference between socialism and communism, and you say, well, Wayne, don't go too far. This may be socialism light, but it's not communism. Not true. The definition of socialism is it's an economic, the economic fit of communism. Every communist country is a socialist economic system. Communism is the weaponization of government. That is by its very definition, the hallmark of communism. It is putting your opponents in prison, it is silencing them, it is banning them from social media, it's burning their books, it's having SWAT teams raid them at 5 a.m, it's raiding Mar-a-Lago, it's raiding the former top officials of the Trump administration while they're getting on a plane and putting them in shackles in front of the crowd, it's blaming the president and indicting the president and arresting the former president for crimes that may or may not have ever existed and don't apply to New York, they're federal and are out of statute of limitations and may not have ever happened and you can't prove they happened. And to weaponize government in such a way that it's being done now reminds me, it's reminiscent of the Soviet Union and Fidel Castro and Venezuela. And yes, I'll go there. I'm Jewish, Nazi Germany. This is what Hitler would have done. You put your opponents in prison, you silence free speech. I think it's worth it for me to mention, Frank, just 3 days ago, I sat in the morning and recorded, taped an interview with a political show in Las Vegas, but it's on YouTube. He does a TV version of it on YouTube and also a radio version in Vegas. And then it's seen all over the country. It's a show for veterans aimed at military heroes, veterans by a veteran host. And I did a 1-hour interview and he texted me yesterday, and he said, Wayne, YouTube took it down and banned it and said it violates community standards, what you said. I sat for an hour. I gave a great interview. I told people what I think about America today. I didn't curse. I didn't say anything terrible. I just told the truth about what's happening. And YouTube banned it. He said he's never had a show banned in the history of YouTube till I came along. So by just talking about the truth, like most hosts are unwilling to do about what's happening, a communist takeover of the United States, YouTube has decided I'm not allowed to speak anymore. And it's not the first time that's happened. It's happened many times. Anything I say in any interview gets taken down by YouTube. Why?
Because walking,
it's the truth.
You're a walking violation of their community standards, but that is because
But that's not America.
No,
that's not America. Even as a Jew, I remember supporting in the late 70s, Frank, I think it was 79. Remember when the KKK and the Nazis marched on Skokie, Illinois, primarily Jewish community? And
the
I said,
ACLU
horrible, I hate
them.
You know, I'd like to kill these guys. But it's America. You got to let them speak. And the ACLU defended them and said, you got to let them speak. And yet today, liberals do not want Wayne Root to speak. How do you explain that? What am I saying? I'm not threatening anyone. I preach no violence.
Wayne,
what could I possibly be saying that threatens him so much? It's called truth.
What we're going to talk later in the program with Bill Walton about a fascinating interview that he did with me on his show, The Bill Walton Show, with Ben Weingart, who is talking about this cybersecurity and infrastructure security agency in the Department of Homeland Security, which now is saying, in the person of its leader, now saying that the infrastructure security agency of the Department of Homeland Security has to be monitoring and safeguarding the so-called cognitive infrastructure of America. And that's where they're catching you up, my friend, among others of us, I think, who are being censored. It's outrageous, and it's not America. You're absolutely right.
And I must
right.
have a file this thick at the FBI because I'm a domestic terrorist, even though I'm a nice, you know, Jewish blue-collar kid from a little town on the Bronx borderline that's never done anything wrong in his life. That is
the
example
record.
Of the American dream.
For
I made
record.
It in America.
You're
I mean,
not.
What have I done wrong? I'm not a bomb thrower. I'm not a criminal. Never committed a crime in my life. How can I be a domestic terrorist? We're dealing with evil.
You support
here,
Donald
it's
Trump.
Evil.
Yeah.
I think
that's,
it's evil.
That's the bottom line.
Well, I think it's demonic what's happening to America.
It is. I couldn't agree with you more, Wayne. Let me just ask, too, about your thoughts on this debt ceiling exercise. As we speak, the president and the speaker of the House have come up with a compromise. Not clear how those in the Republican caucus, at least in the House Freedom Caucus, perceive this. What are your thoughts about whether this is an acceptable arrangement for increasing the debt ceiling by, as I understand it, $4 trillion for the next 2 years?
Yeah, I mean, I'll answer both your questions because I never really answered the first one. I know you're limited on time. So the first one, the answer to the Durham report is that I believe all roads lead to Obama. It's clear everything bad was done by the CIA, the FBI, the DOJ, and Hillary Clinton was all orchestrated and approved by Obama, the sitting president of the United States in 2016, to try and steal an election, a presidential election. And then we know they used a triple the strength to actually try and rig the 2020 election. I think they succeeded at it very well. So in my opinion, all roads lead to Obama, and I believe Obama should be indicted. Just like they indicted Trump for nothing, Obama should be indicted for something real. And as far as your second question, the debt ceiling, it's this, they're all tied together. We just never seem to win, Frank. You know, even when Trump was president, only Republicans got indicted by the FBI and the DOJ. No Democrats ever get indicted. No one ever gets punished. And the same thing with the debt ceiling. Even when we control the House, we never win the negotiations. I think it was a terrible negotiation. Do I think it was the worst possible? No, because if Democrats control the House and the Senate and the presidency, you wouldn't even believe how bad it would have been. So thank God we control the House. So at least we stopped them and slowed their growth just a little bit. But it was not a good negotiation by McCarthy. I've never liked him. I've never thought he's on our team. I think he's wishy-washy, just like McConnell, just like Rona McDaniel. I think McDaniel, McConnell, and McCarthy are all bad leaders and don't represent real base of the Republican Party. And I think it was a pretty crappy negotiation. I think the number one issue that should have been solved was there should be no more 87,000 new IRS agents. and they did virtually nothing to it. McCarthy's bragging he got it down to 86,000. You know, out of 87 billion, whatever the number was, he got it cut to 86 billion. So now there'll be 86,000 IRS agents instead of 87,000. That's a horrible negotiation. That was the most important point that should have come out of it. Wasn't even the national debt. It was that we're not going to allow the IRS to hire all these new agents who they're advertising should carry guns and be willing to kill people and are going to come after nothing but conservatives and critics of the Democrat administration. And anybody who tells the truth will be labeled as misleading, and they want the IRS to go after them. Horrible negotiation by Kevin McCarthy.
We couldn't agree more on all of that. Wayne Allard Root, thank you so much for your time today, as well as this important new book, a guidebook, really, for what you can do with your money, The Great Patriot Boycott. Check it out, folks, and get it wherever books are sold, as they say. God bless you, my friend. Come back to us with updates, if you would, very soon.
Thanks, Frank. Right, God bless. God bless America.
Right after this. Amen.
In cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to Peter Husey, the senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, who specializes there on nuclear deterrence issues, a topic that he has devoted most of his professional life to, including decades of sponsoring, salons, breakfasts, lunches, dinners, and all manner of events to showcase the importance of having a credible nuclear deterrent and what it takes for the United States to do that, especially after what some have called a kind of busman's holiday that the American political elite has taken with respect to the necessary steps to maintain and upgrade, over time especially, our deterrent capabilities. Peter is... always welcome here. It's good to talk with you, my friend. Welcome back.
Thank you very much, Frank. It's always an honor to be here.
Thank you. Let me start by asking you to sort of lay out what you've described as kind of a framework for thinking about the challenge of maintaining effective deterrent capabilities at a dangerous time, such as we find ourselves in at the moment.
Yeah, well, thank you, Frank. I want to start with the retired Admiral Richard, who just came out of STRATCOM. In his testimony last year, said something that is very, very important. He said, all our tabletop exercises, all our war games, where conventionally we win, none of them work if nuclear weapons are introduced. That's a very profound thing. And then he says...
Introduce meaning used by the adversary, I take it.
And that then gets you into the business of, okay, are we going to nuclear modernize? And that is, again, his... He also said, if we don't modernize, we're out of the nuclear business. We got legacy programs that are 40, 50, and 60 years old, and they can't last that much longer. We're kind of rolling the dice. As Senator Shaheen said, we're going to wake up someday without modernization. We basically end up without a deterrent. So that gives you the third.
Peter, let me just ask you, this is more than just a matter of the obsolescence of these nuclear capabilities. It's also a question of whether they're the right kinds of weapons for deterring in the present environment. Well, is that not the case?
Sustainability is very difficult because they're expensive. And
Understood.
He's doing a pretty heroic job of maintaining 40, 50, and 60-year-old stuff while they're bringing the stuff in simultaneously to replace it. The third issue, and this General Cotton hinted at in his testimony this spring, he said, the hedge we have, which is a warheads extra that we have in case things break down, he said that was 2010. And he was very pointed in his answer to Senator Cotton. The question is, the hedge in 2010 is not the hedge we need in 2023. Be very subtle about it, but that's key. Now, the fourth thing is...
Before you go to the fourth thing, Peter, just tease that out. You're talking about having some kind of hedge against strategic threat developments. And between 2010 and 2023, 13 years, we've seen some very important and ominous developments. Just give us a quick... rundown on those.
He has nuclear weapons, and China is going to go to 1,500 as a minimum, I believe. Iran might, and Russia has a whole lot of systems that aren't even controlled by arms control. And what the hedge was, what if the New START treaty breaks down? We need to be able to build up if that's our decision. But the question is, the hedge we put into place then was before the Chinese threat. In fact, the NPR at the time said we thought China and Russia might be cooperative in terms of going after proliferation or going after terrorists with nuclear weapons, which didn't turn out to be the case.
Fatuous nonsense. So, yeah. And that's the nuclear posture review. Yeah. And you're talking about Joe Biden's sort of foundational document for what kind of deterrent we have.
In those days, that was. But the key is now we've identified gaps which we need to fill. And that it goes beyond the New START treaty. It basically is theater systems like the cruise missile for the Navy, or the going after deep underground buried targets. And also, we have 50 extra Minuteman missiles we could add, and we could add warheads to the D-5 missile on the submarines. And that comes to the fifth point, which is really important, which is whatever you may think about arms control, for or against it, dream up whatever you want. We're not going to go to abolition, okay? Arms control doesn't solve a single one of these problems. If you banned MIRV land-based missiles, you could deal with some of it. But the theater systems is what I worry about, what Putin says escalate to win, meaning if I'm in a conventional fight with you and I think I'm not winning, I'll threaten to use nuclear weapons to get you to stand down. I think Xi Jinping has the same attitude, and he's developing weapons in that respect. And as you know, China is under no control, no limits, with respect to any of its forces in the nuclear business, and has shown no interest in basically even being transparent about, okay, what do you have? So,
to the contrary, I think they go to great lengths to conceal what they have, and certainly don't want to have any kind of arms control limitations placed upon them. But Peter, just again to go back here for a moment, you're talking about strategic intercontinental range missiles with multiple warheads on them. If you could eliminate through some kind of arms control arrangement those residing in Russian inventories, those residing in Chinese inventories, and of course whatever we've got left, you would somehow mitigate the threat, but there's zero likelihood that any of that would eventuate, right? The only thing we could actually do, which has generally been my experience and critique of arms control, is unilaterally reduce our own capabilities.
Yeah, that's the thing is the START II treaty did, and it was Reagan's vision to get rid of land-based MIRV missiles. They're at 99% alert. They're solid fueled, so they can be launched very quickly. Without them, Gorbachev wrote an op-ed in the New York Times saying, Russia will go broke because Russia can't build enough warheads on single warhead missiles. So that was the whole idea, but the Duma turned it down. And my criticism of the arms control community and of the Clinton administration is they didn't really make any effort to get the Russian Duma to, I would have bribed them all with a dock on the Black Sea and nailed that down. Now, who knows whether down the road they bust it, but that would have been, but we're not going there. And so what I'm,
we're definitely not going there. That's for sure.
Arms control can't solve the problems we face. And yet, as soon as there's a description of the threat, we immediately see the media go to, oh, we can do arms control. Well, yes, you can. But are you going to solve any of the problems? No, it does. Not a substitute for modernization, not a substitute for the hedge, not a substitute for missile defense. And it's not a substitute for keeping deterrence at bay so that you can fight conventionally, God forbid, if you have to.
Right. So, Peter, you mentioned missile defense. How does that fit into this increasingly problematic situation where we have formidable adversaries now in concert?
Yeah.
And it is the Russians and the Chinese for sure. I think it's a matter of days, if it hasn't already happened, before the Iranians are in the mix, even at a small level. The North Koreans are certainly on board with that team. All of that's gone on. There is no real prospect of arms control making a difference. Our forces are obsolescent at best and are being only gradually modernized. So missile defense, it would seem, takes on a greater responsibility as the option of choice. But is there any prospect that we're actually going to have an effective missile defense, particularly one in space, which is where they could be most
effective? I've talked to a number of members of the House and Senate, and the debate needs to be had, because in their view, we'd win. My view is, if you're talking about thousands of nuclear weapons coming at you, no, you can't shoot them all down. But if escalate to win is using a limited number, air defense, cruise missile defense, and missile defense all of a sudden become not only very valuable, I can shoot down 20, I can shoot down 50. And especially if it's space-based, and we are finally, we're building a radar that looks south for cruise missiles and ballistic missiles, which most people in America, I don't think, understand, we do not have. Finally, it's
completely vulnerable that way.
It's in the budget, and both North Korea and Iran have launched missiles using a southern trajectory. Everybody assumes you're going to go over the pole because that's the North Pole, this distance to America. But they both have launched the other way, and we don't have any radars looking there. So my view is missile defense now becomes even more important, because if they go big, they're dead, because it's Armageddon. Paul Mincy said that's the suicide option. But if they go limited, which is what they're threatening to do, missile defense can play an extraordinary role. And everybody who I know in this business now says it's affordable and I can do it in a timely manner. And the thing is, we haven't had that debate, because you still think, oh, we don't want to upset the Russian deterrent, or we don't want to Chinese deterrent, which is...
This is the hangover of the ABM Treaty, Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty of 1972, right, which we finally, under George W. Bush, got out of. But Peter, let me just ask you, because one of the things that I think is an important takeaway from what we've seen Israel doing, right, as it has confronted significant and growing missile and rocket threats, is the use of their missile defenses, which, proud to say, I think we had a hand in getting them, because we signed a bilateral agreement with the Israelis back in the 1980s to share technology and collaborate in other ways. But Peter, you know, they use defenses preferentially to protect the things they value most. You don't need to stop everything. You need to just be able to defeat a planner's strategy for how they're going to take down their enemy, namely us. And I think this is really a critical point. As you say, the options are available now that weren't before, in terms of affordability, in terms of the technology. We just need to get off the dime and get them in place as quickly as we possibly can. I'm out of time, Peter. I can't take aboard your last comment, but I think you're endorsing what I just said, and I certainly am endorsing what you previously said. So we'll leave it at that for the moment, but we'll have you back soon for a further conversation on all of this. In the meantime, thanks for the strategic thinking you're doing in this space. We need it. God knows. We'll be right back with more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. There would never be a good time to say farewell to a magnificent patriot and courageous editorialist, essayist, and investigative reporter like my friend Claudia Rosette. But her loss at this particular moment in the arc of her profession is nothing short of devastating.
For decades, Claudia epitomized the working journalist who served as our founders intended, namely as an independent, honest check on the three branches of government, fearlessly speaking truth to power. She did the same with tyrants abroad. Claudia Rosette was an exemplar of authentic reporting. More to the point, she practiced it the way we desperately require at present. Those who believe that it amounts to nothing more than reprinting official press releases and collaborating in the suppression of dissenting views will have a special place in hell, as Claudia surely has one in heaven. This is Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our guest, regular feature of this program about this time, and that would be Bill Walton, a recovering master of the universe on Wall Street, these days the host of a terrific television podcast program, The Bill Walton Show. You can find it, among other places, at the CPAC channel, and we're wanting to talk with Bill about a very important interview that I had the privilege of sharing with him in his studio the other day with Benjamin Weingarten, man, no stranger to this program as well, but a really formidable intellect, as well as duty expert on so many of the public policy challenges of our time. And Bill, I wanted to thank you for having been on and to visit with you a little bit about some of the really important takeaways from that conversation with him about this cybersecurity and infrastructure security agency within the Department of Homeland Security, what it's up to and what should be of grave concern to all of us.
Well, Frank, I was delighted you could join because you've got such subject matter expertise. This is one of the really terrific deep dive shows I've done, and thanks in part to you. But Ben testified in front of Congress a couple of weeks ago to one of the subcommittees, Homeland Security subcommittees. And the topic was what's happening with the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, fondly known with another acronym in Washington, CISA. And Homeland Security, as we know, has experienced massive mission drift, turning its attention from foreign enemies to what they now perceive as domestic enemies. Essentially, they mean, you know, they're aiming at Trump voters, and CISA has been. We've heard about the Twitter files and the fact that Twitter had visitors from FBI and all the other security agencies during the last 4 or 5 years to coordinate what the social media companies were doing at the behest of the Biden White House and the rest of the administration. Well, CISA has been all in, not as well known, but they've been a convening agency for a lot of the meetings that have been held with all of the other security agencies in the government and the social media companies. And one of the very chilling things that they've done is that, you know, they're to legitimize the attack on so-called domestic terrorists, they've taken their mandate as one of which is protecting the infrastructure of the United States. And they've declared that the American mind is part of the American infrastructure. And this is directly from Jen Easterly, who now heads it. She calls it our cognitive infrastructure. And she's using it as an excuse to protect such infrastructure from bad thought. And
Disinformation, misinformation. And
this is really straight out of I'm sorry, Frank, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to capture the breadth of this. There's disinformation and misinformation and malinformation that is all the sort of thing that the American mind and cognitive infrastructure now needs to be protected against. Now, Bill, we were hearing some time ago about this disinformation governance board. And with some fanfare, that was interred. But it sounds as though CISA is simply, you know, packaging up that old wine in new bottles, if you will, and that we're looking at a similar kind of governmental involvement in censorship of the American people.
Well, they disbanded that board, but they quickly recreated a new one. And I'm looking in my notes as to what euphemism they've called it. But they have another disinformation board that they're standing up, which has roughly the same agenda, or essentially almost entirely the same agenda. Only, but I don't think they're going to pick the Mary Poppins impersonator to run it. That was a bad PR move. But it's not a joke. I mean, talk about misinformation, disinformation, malinformation. These are the terms that they use to so-called protect America from bad actors. Malinformation, I think, is the most pernicious, which they call, it's based on fact, but it's used out of context to mislead, harm, or manipulate. So in other words, we can be reporting out facts on our Twitter feed or our Facebook or any of other platforms, but even though we're talking about facts, if we put it in a context that CISA doesn't think protects the American people, they'll shut it down.
Bill, this is extremely chilling, and it gives a focus to what I wanted to talk about briefly. We talk about China a lot on this program with you because you've really developed a great expertise on the subject, and we'll do more of that in the second block. But I just wanted to say, by way of kind of a segue, a woman who really was a prime example of getting factual information to the American people fearlessly, whether it was, speaking truth to power about what was going on inside her own government, or very commendably, what she would report about what foreign tyrants, whether it was Saddam Hussein or Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping or their predecessors, she was extraordinarily formidable as an exemplar of what I think journalism should be. Her name was Claudia Rosette. She was for many years an author, a writer, an editorialist, an essayist for much of her career with the Wall Street Journal. And we just lost her, I'm so sorry to say, over the weekend to, I think, cancer. And I just, as you talk about what journalism has become these days, in partnership with these disinformation, malinformation, misinformation, censoring organizations within the United States government, which the last time I checked is absolutely unconstitutional, and yet too many in the media, particularly in the social media, have been playing along, have been doing the bidding of the government. And I think the cognitive infrastructure of the United States is considerably worse as a result. Bill, I want to give you a chance to just say a word about that, but it's going to be on the other side of a very short break. Bill Walton is with us, the host of The Bill Walton Show, a friend and colleague who had, I'm very pleased to say, a segment with me, not only with Ben Weingarten, but about our new book. Did I mention it yet? No, I don't think I did. The Indictment. And Bill, thank you for that as well. When we come back, we'll talk China, as well as a woman who was exposing at Tiananmen, as well as elsewhere, what was really going on inside that new evil empire. Be right back with more right after this. We're back, and we're visiting with Bill Walton, as we have the privilege of doing each week, the host of The Bill Walton Show. You can find it, among other places, at the CPAC channel. He had last night on that program and fascinating interview with Ben Weingarten. But Bill, I wanted to give you a chance to talk a little bit about Claudia Rosette as well. I don't think you knew her, but you've had a chance to take stock of what she was all about. And I'd love to get your appreciation of her work as well.
Well, one of the things I think made her so effective is she was rooted in the life she lived. Her father was dean of the University of Chicago Business School and was a famous free market advocate. And as a little girl, she served tea and cookies to Rose and Milton Friedman in Chicago. And so she grew up by the side of the chair of some of the greatest thinkers in economics. And she brought that she got her own MBA at U of C, and she brought a lot of that thinking about how corporations and policy and national security interact, and I think it made her one of the really, truly great reporters. She also, as you mentioned, wasn't afraid to go into the action. She was in Hong Kong, heard some new rumors that something big was happening in Beijing, got on a plane, went to a hotel overlooking Tiananmen Square, and she was there. And she was the only reporter who was able to report firsthand about the massacre of 10,000 protesters in was it, Frank, 1987, 89?
She did it, as always, with great courage because you weren't reporting from inside China.
Well, she went to Siberia to take a firsthand look at the prison camps there, the worker camps.
Yeah, she was based in Moscow at the time. Now, a remarkable woman, freedom fighter and great friend, and we mourn her passing deeply. Bill, let me pivot further to one of the topics that we always cover with you and that Claudia covered, as you say, very commendably as well, and that is China. There's growing evidence that the Chinese Communist Party's crackdown using counterintelligence statutes is having a very chilling effect on American companies doing business in China, and rightly so. Some, including Amazon, seem to be now bailing out in droves, according to one article, and it's causing, I guess, even the banks in China, the Western banks doing business there, investing our money there, and so on, are now coming to grips with a harsh reality, namely, I guess, that Xi Jinping is not interested in their business and is willing to take matters into his own hands to make their lives very difficult indeed. Have I got that about right? And what are the implications of it?
Well, it's ominous, Frank. I mean, we saw a year and a half, 2 years ago, President Xi beginning to go after the large technology companies in China, exercising his whip hand over the CEOs and billionaires that were running those because they weren't doing, in his view, the government's bidding. He also shut down all the private tutoring companies in China because he wanted to control the flow of information to students to make sure they were getting President Xi speak. And then, of course, they locked down the country in an egregious way with the zero COVID strategy. But just as they were beginning to open up the country and people, foreign investors and foreign companies doing business there were beginning to think the dust was going to settle, it is not. They've passed two different versions, each one more egregious than the next, of their national security law, and they basically deputized every single Chinese in America, or I'm sorry, in China, to protect state security. They've really shut down the ability of U.S. companies to do diligence or international companies to do diligence in China. All the firms that did that have had I think they call it the black men or the black police show up in their offices, and a couple of them now you can only see the glass doors with locks on them because they're no longer in business. Xi doesn't want U.S. accounting firms, the Big Four in particular, to be auditing Chinese companies, and there's getting to be people. You know, we talked about how long it's going to take business to figure this out. Well, they're beginning to figure it out. Amazon just recently completely shut down its operation in China. They'd shut down one of the domestic websites a couple of years ago, but now they pulled completely out, including the ability to buy things on their Kindle, their Kindle store. Airbnb has pulled out of China. Yahoo has ended its services in China. LinkedIn is getting out of China. And it's just recently, I think they've announced they've completely withdrawn from China. The U.S. securities firms, which have been making a fortune in China with equity listings, in part because of the work you all have done with, we've done with the China.
Yeah, the present danger China. Yeah.
Present danger China. Chinese companies are not raising equity in U.S. markets, and that was a big source of fees. The other thing is the banking system, which was purportedly so antiquated, and they need an American expertise to come in and run the capital markets for them. Well, they've decided that maybe the banking system in China is not so bad, and they're locking arms, and they're keeping U.S. and other international security firms out of the business. And so Xi's essentially saying, we don't need you all to run China. Now, the ominous part of that is not just that it's, you know, there's not a business opportunity there. The ominous part is it looks like he's battening down China for kinetic action.
For a war.
He wants to make sure that he's not dependent on foreign companies, foreign suppliers. And in particular, he doesn't want foreign companies nosing around to find out what's really happening in China. So this is one we're going to have to keep covering because it's getting worse with each passing month.
Yeah, it certainly is. At the same time, we have his new ambassador to the United States urging Chinese students to serve the motherland. I wonder what that could entail in time of war. There are some 300,000 of them in this country, Bill Walton, as you know, and it's very likely, I would say, that they and other Chinese nationals, businessmen, spies for sure, to say nothing of the subject of what we talked about in our marvelous webinar on Friday of last week, namely Chinese young men coming over in what seems to be organized groups, bearing the hallmarks of the Chinese People's Liberation Army. Bill, we're out of time. I got to leave it at that for the moment, but we will have you back next week, God willing, and I thank you for all you've done for our country and are doing now in connection with your terrific program.
Much more coming, Frank.
Looking forward to it. Thanks to all of you for joining us for this edition. Come back next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.